This is the Dallas Morning News.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Sports Day Insider, presented by the Dallas Morning News. I am Kevin Sherrington, joined by Evan Grant and David Moore. David Moore just got back from Big Ben. Came back alive, no problems of any kind, no weather problems. The good thing was that you went in February, March, and not in June, July, right?
June, July, August, where I believe last year on the floor of Big Bend, it was getting 117 for quite a stretch when we had our heat wave up here. It is amazing just how vast and dramatic that landscape is. And, we were talking about a little bit earlier, they're really only, unless you stay in the park, which we did, we stayed up in Chisos Mountain Lodge, which is right in the middle of the park. But in the middle of the park, it's still about 45, 50 minutes to wherever it is you want to go in the park. I mean, it is the wide open spaces of West Texas for sure. And, but, you know, really the only cities outside of the park that are closest that you stay to and kind of entry points are on opposite sides. One is Marathon, and then on the other side is Terlingua. And both of those are 45 minutes from those towns to the entryway into the park. So it's quite a place, but it is gorgeous. And this time of year, it's spectacular and manageable as far as getting out and hiking.
I've always wanted to go. I'm a Texas boy, born and bred, never lived anyplace else my whole life, and I've never been to Big Bend.
Well, it's so remote, right? That. I mean, yeah. We drove out there, and you're talking 9 hours. If you stop for lunch, it's really closer to 10. And but there's, you either fly into El Paso.
Not the way Kevin drives. It's not the way Kevin drives. Woo, doggy.
There's still some parts where he would slow down, let me tell you.
When he gets up ahead of steam in that old pickup truck, it just.
Hey, I have news about the pickup truck, which is very sad, but we donated to Dallas Cat Academy, retired it. 17 years we had that truck. We gave that to Jake when he was a junior in high school in 2007. And then he drove it for a long time. Ford drove it for a couple semesters in college. And then I drove it. And then Madeline drove it. And we had a picture taken of him, of Jake with the truck and his two children. Now, it was kind of fun to see that, but it was sad to see it go away. The kids they told me that I have to write a book about it, and I'm going to call it The Red Truck. So I'm going to write it like a children's
book. Nice.
It'll be fun.
Nice.
It'll be fun.
Well, was it getting about 8 miles a gallon at the end? Was that about?
I don't know. I tell you what, as our old friend Barry Horn, he loved that truck because when you started that thing up and had those twin tailpipes on it, it gave you a good rumble. It was nice. It was fun.
Well, you should have taken it to West Texas before you retired it to Dallas Can Academy because you were. I think there are actually per capita there are 2.7 trucks for every person in West Texas.
Yeah, I'm sure there are, and probably a lot of those old Ford Red trucks too. That was pretty universal model. That 2001.
Boys. That was some good truck talk.
It was good truck talk. I liked it. That was the second one it's actually the third vehicle we've donated. The first one we donated was our 95 Suburban, which we put 342,000 miles on, original engine and transmission when it went. That was also very emotional when that one went too. Kind of into like large segments of my life, a lot of miles were piled up, a lot of memories piled up in those vehicles. So it's a lot of fun. But if you get a chance to do that kind of thing, I think it's good to donate those to. It's not called Dallas Can Academy anymore. I can't remember. Texas Can Academy or something like that. But anyway, it's the same thing. You look it up. You can find it.
Evan? How many Hemis do you have on your truck?
I No Hemis or Emmys for my truck. Gina's Big Bertha, as she likes to call her Mazda SUV, is 15 years old, and we're trying to get one more year out of it before we do whatever we do with it. So this will be a new experience for me, and she loves Big Bertha, but Big Bertha's on Social Security now.
Well, that's a sad thing when these vehicles go. They're like part of the family.
Have you ever named your cars? Apparently, this is a thing. I've never named any of my cars.
Not since I was 17. No.
Yeah, my daughter did. I never did. No.
Yeah. Yeah. We just identify them by the colors or the kind of vehicle.
I usually just call it my car. I didn't need to single it out from anybody else's.
Yes, it's true. Well, speaking of family, Dak Prescott has a little girl now, MJ. Did we get a clarification on what MJ stands for? Is he a Michael Jordan fan?
He chose not to give the actual name because he dropped it yesterday. We were talking, and he was the one who dropped the fact that his first child had arrived. And so then we followed up, and he said, last week. And then I asked him, do you care to share the name with us? To which he said, let's just call her Baby MJ. So, and in fact, I saw on a social media last night, I saw a photo of Dak's brother holding Baby MJ for the first time, showing the photo, and they superimposed a smiley face over the baby's face, so you can't see who it is.
Well, that's probably smart.
No, that's not a bad thing.
No, not a bad thing at all.
What did you ask Dak about his haircut?
Well, maybe I actually did. Maybe in a moment away from the crowd, Dak may have actually showed me a picture of the baby, and it's very cute. But well, of course, what baby? What? You know, 1 week old isn't cute. But yeah, it was
me. I wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was like, okay, I can see baby that
with you, wasn't it?
Did you ask that? What about the haircut? What would that? Because that seemed to be a big story too. How's the haircut?
He said he just wanted to clean up a little bit. You know, he says a mustache is coming later. We'll see how it goes. And I did see also on social media, which is the arbiter of good taste, as we all know. I did see some photos today, side by side, comparing him to the Salamancas from Breaking Bad.
Wow.
Has that Salamanca look to him?
Man, that's a little harsh. That's a little harsh. All right, we've got to get going here, fellas. Let's talk about the Rangers.
I thought we weren't going. I thought we were
on a roll, Kevin.
It's all good stuff, and I like all of it, but I'm sure a lot of
facial hair, children.
Who are these guys? What are they talking about? not that they don't do that anyway. But anyway, let's talk about the Rangers. Scott Boras is out there saying, hey, there's a lot of people interested in my guys, Blake Snell and Jordan Montgomery. Which, sounds just like something Scott Boras would say at this time of year. But there may be something to that because, Evan, you have some news to report about the Boston Red Sox and Lucas Giolito.
Well, I like how you always like tease this to like breaking news. And by the time it gets out there after with pre-production and everything, it's going to be old. But I mean, I do think that this is what Boras has kind of been waiting for since spring training started was the best way to create a little bit more leverage for his pitchers was for somebody to have a pitcher go down. And Boston is now the word out of Boston is that Lucas Giolito, who the Red Sox signed to a 2-year deal, has a partial tear in his UCL and could be headed for surgery. And so that's going to change some things where the Red Sox are concerned. I don't know if they had insurance on Giolito or not, but if they did, then certainly they're not out nearly as much money. It may make them a little bit easier. It may make it a little bit easier for them to go out and spend on either Montgomery or Snell. Until Jordan Montgomery signs with somebody else at this point in time, I feel like the Rangers are still going to be in the mix. It's a question of whether or not anybody can convince Ray Davis to do it. But until he walks into somebody else's clubhouse, I can't rule the Rangers out.
Yeah. And of course, it's still awfully early to see how these guys are throwing. I know that Nate Eovaldi had a really nice outing his first time out. And, you know, Dane Dunning is now throwing a fork ball occasionally. And we'll see how some of this stuff goes. You know, there's nothing to tell from any of this so far.
No, the only thing to tell from spring training so far regarding the Rangers pitching are these two things. Fortunately, you know, nearly 3 weeks in, there's been no significant injury to the pitching staff. Two, on the other end of it, the four guys that should be candidates to help this team out as depth internally, none of them have taken a step forward. You know, Jack Leiter, I think, was still going to be some time away. But Owen White, Cole Wynn, Zach Kent, none of those guys has taken a step forward that would make Bruce Bochy or Mike Maddox say, hey, I'm intrigued. And that's been probably the most disappointing development of spring training.
Yeah, and what makes it a little bit makes you wince a little more, and I brought this up with you yesterday, was I read something that Jeff Passan had for ESPN talking about players who have caused a lot of buzz in spring training, and the very first guy he listed was Cole Reagans with Kansas City. And what he talked about was how one talent evaluator told him that he's a left-handed Jacob DeGrom, which I know kind of gets you all hot and bothered that if you compare anybody to Jacob DeGrom. He wasn't talking about his injury history either, which I guess you could have.
Could, though. Right? He could.
Yeah, you could have say been. That. But the thing about it was that just the fact that he was throwing so hard, there's so much, you know, life in his ball. He was averaging 99.1 miles per hour on his fastball. And as Passan concluded, if he stays healthy, he could be one of the best pitchers in the game. Which, let's go there then. Let's talk about that, because obviously they traded Cole Reagans last year for Aroldis Chapman. And as I asked you yesterday, do you think?
Well, let's just step back for 1 second before we go into that. Let me just say this: my issue with comparing a player to Jacob DeGrom or to Mike Trout or to Julio Rodriguez is those guys are the outliers. You know, if you get that kind of talent, that's great. It's just unfair to compare anybody to that level of talent and to use those kinds of guys as comps. I know it's meant as a compliment, but I just think it's unfair. That said, that's my take on a DeGrom comp. To your point, and let's go back into your point now about how hard he's throwing and whether or not the Rangers made a mistake on this trade.
Well, okay. Well, that was the question I was going to, but first we have to ask if, because as we know, if you can get yourself to a World Series or win a World Series, then that's it. You know, if you have to give up something to do that, and if it hurts you down the line, it hurts you down the line, but, you know, flags fly forever. So that's the question we have to ask first. Do the Rangers get to the World Series without Aroldis Chapman?
I don't know if they get to the playoffs without Aroldis Chapman. I think I could be more definitive that they get to the World Series without him, but I'm not sure they get to the playoffs, because he rallied that bullpen in July and part of August. He really kind of ran into a wall in September when they were able to reassign some of the starters to the bullpen. The bullpen took on a completely different dynamic. So
yeah, for a couple of weeks he was pretty dominant.
Yes. And I think he served a purpose, and there was an absolute need for relief help, for late inning relief help. It was a desperate need for relief help in May and June. He was the best arm on the market at that point in time. I think the question here goes a little bit deeper than flags fly forever. I know you and I talked about this, Kevin, and I'm not sure if we'll be able to recreate that entire conversation, but you know, to just say flags fly forever, I think becomes a little bit flippant. They won a World Series, and that is significant. The question here is, did they make a mistake in evaluating Cole Reagans? Could they have made that trade for Aroldis Chapman without giving up Cole Reagans? And more importantly, they made that trade. They won a World Series. That worked out. They could be faced with a similar situation again this year. They're probably, if they're going to contend, they're probably going to have to make a deadline deal. What can they learn from this evaluation process so that they don't potentially give up a guy who turns into one of the best starters or best position players in the American League?
Was Cole Reagans throwing 99 last year? That's the thing. I thought it was 96, wasn't it?
I mean, he had touched 99 with the Rangers a little bit, but when he was pitching out of the bullpen, it was pretty much, 96, 95, 96.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
And it was up. The velocity was up from where it had been, but it wasn't 99, 100 regularly. And that's a big part of it. The other part of it is, he didn't really throw a slider that much with the Rangers. And when he got to the Royals, they let him loose with the slider, and he's been really good with it.
Yeah, he has. Well, that's the thing. It's not just this spring, obviously. Yeah, after the trade was made, he was very good. He was the pitcher of the month, for the 1 month. So, I mean, he really has come into his own. And I guess what makes it look bad now, Evan, is two things. One, the Rangers have never developed pitchers, just never. And so all of a sudden, here's a guy that's being talked about as one of the best pitchers in baseball if he stays healthy, which, that's going to be really problematic. He's going to throw 99 and 100 and 101. It's going to be problematic for him to stay healthy when he already has a history. So I would always have that as a caveat. But I do know Rangers fans, and it's me too. I mean, the further it gets away from that World Series title, people are going to go, if Cole Reagans ends up being one of the best pitchers in baseball, they're going to remember that and how Aroldis Chapman finished. How every time he went out there at the end, you just thought, this is just throwing gas on a fire, because he was very ineffective in the World Series. He wasn't any good at all, and he was pretty good in the ALCS, and they kind of used him judiciously and kind of got in and out of messes, and it didn't let him go too far. Of course, you didn't have to get too far with him. You knew within five pitches how good he was going to be on any particular day, but that's just going to hurt more. If the Rangers didn't have this history of problems with developing pitchers, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. It'd be a deal, but not that big of a deal. The fact that they just can never do it, and then this is the one guy that they finally developed, and that's the guy they traded for a reliever who was a 1 year, or was a rental.
Listen, I think you get to the World Series and you win the World Series, it may be a high price to pay, but you view it as a solid investment. The important part is what can you do differently going forward? And Kevin, we've been over this a million times. The Rangers have to review how they develop pitchers, and they have to do some self-auditing there. I think the other thing that hasn't factored into this to this point is that there was a real inherent level of risk with Cole Wynn as a guy who had two Tommy John's elbow reconstructions back to back. And there's no sample size of guys having a third Tommy John surgery. So there's no room for another injury there. He'd be in unprecedented territory. All of that said, there are a lot of guys who have had a second Tommy John and come back and pitched for a long period of time. So that's the risk factor that Kansas City was willing to take on. But there's no doubt they got an arm, and they had identified some things that they could do to allow Cole Reagans to really take the next step. And that's what the Rangers have to evaluate. Where are they missing?
Yeah, well, there was no risk for the Royals in that deal. They're just going to roll this Chapman. That was no problem for them. That's the thing on the Kansas City side. It's like, for a guy that was just a rental, we weren't going to keep anyway. We're
correct,
not going
but could
anywhere.
could you have made that trade for Cole Wynn? Could you have taken a harder line and made that trade for somebody lesser? That's the question the Rangers also have to answer.
They do, but the point you make is about, so he goes to the Royals and they say, hey, how about using your slider more often? And it works really well for him. See, it's things like that that you're going to have to look at too, is that, you know, and I got to tell you, Evan, I defer to these guys. They obviously know a lot more about all of this than we do. But to me, do you talk to pitchers about what makes their most comfortable throwing? Is that what you get them to do? Obviously it's not a one size fits all. You know, there's different pitchers with different things. You know, we've talked about, you know, Jonathan Gray and that, you know, he needs a third pitch and, you know, and so he is working on that now. You know, and to me, Jonathan Gray is a perfect example, a guy with tremendous stuff, but you know, you got to worry about the head a little bit. I mean, I don't know how confident Jonathan Gray is in his stuff. I just think that it's an interesting thing to me how you deal with these guys and how you know, each one of them and how comfortable they are with what they throw. Should you challenge a guy more? Should you let a guy throw something he's more comfortable throwing? I mean, obviously the Royals made that decision pretty quickly on Cole Reagans and it paid off right away. It's like, you know, I don't want to say that the Rangers screwed that up, but it's like you said, if they could have, you know, we don't know what the trade talks were like. We don't know if the Royals were demanding Cole Reagans or not. You know, maybe they could have sent him somebody else. That goes back to that, you know, if you remember the A-Rod trade to the Yankees, and they gave him a whole list of, guys that they could take, and one of the guys was Robinson Cano, you know. And the Rangers took Alfonso Soriano, who was pretty good too.
No, they took old what's his name?
No, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, there are two guys. They could have had
Joaquin Arias.
They could have had both of them, right? Wasn't that the deal?
They could have had. Well, the Soriano was the big piece in that deal, but Arias, it was Arias or Cano, and they took Arias.
Yeah. So those are the kind of things that, you know, are legend in any kind of sports when you make trades and who goes in and who doesn't go in. And look, you don't know how these guys are going to turn out. This is just like the thing with Cole Reagans too, is that, okay, they let him throw the slider. Then all of a sudden the speed on his fastball goes up 3 or 4 miles an hour. It's like, what caused that at 26? You know, and that's the issue with pitchers. I mean, you know, when you draft them, develop them, whatever, you just never know what's going to happen with these guys. I don't know if there's anything more infuriating than trying to do that. And you would think, though, that at some point you would at least get lucky, right? And the Rangers have not even been lucky in that regard. So
I can't disagree with any of that. I mean, it's just the state of the Rangers pitching development remains an issue. It's an issue. It was an issue going into last season. It was an issue that they tried to address in drafts in 21 and 22 with Leiter and Rocker. It was an issue this offseason when they didn't really have a whole bunch of internal candidates. And it's an issue right now when you look across the facility and surprise, and there might be a guy with as good a stuff in the American League that you traded for a rental. So all of that is just another chapter in a franchise long saga of struggling to develop a pitcher.
All right. So let's switch over here before we get out of the Rangers segment and at least talk about something that they are good at, and that's identifying hitters. So Evan, at this point now with camp starting to wind down a little bit, your guess at designated hitter would be that Wyatt Langford breaks camp as the primary DH?
I think Langford breaks camp with this team, and I would expect that at least 50% of his at-bats early on would come via the DH role. He fits in a lot of ways. You know, he is an adequate corner outfielder, and so if you want to – on occasion match up with by sitting Leody Taveras against on a bad split against a left-handed pitcher. You could potentially go Evan Carter in center field and Wyatt Langford in left. If you want to get Adolis Garcia off his feet once a week, you can certainly move Evan Carter to right field and play Wyatt Langford in left. And so I think that there's an opportunity for Wyatt to get two or three other days a week in the field and get two or three days at DH where he's basically the equivalent of a full-time player. They've been really impressed with what they've seen in batting practice. The first couple of games that he played didn't have great results. They worked on a slight swing adjustment. Really his first adjustment as a pro, he comes out and he hits three homers over the course of 2 days. And so there is a whole lot of optimism about what this guy can do for this team, and that, yeah, they do believe he's ready to play in the big leagues.
Isn't this a best case scenario though for this outfield? I mean, let's just take away everything else. Let's take away Zeke Duran. Let's take away Justin Foscue. Anything else that's going on in the infield with injuries and people being out with Corey Seager. And as much as I love Travis Jankowski, I think he's a terrific fourth outfielder and he did a tremendous job for the Rangers last year. But the idea of these four guys, as you just outlined, moving between designated hitter and those outfield positions, to me, makes this potentially maybe the best outfield in baseball. I just feel like that the production level there, the defensive capabilities of these guys, and the fact that obviously we know that it fits best for these guys, I think. And I think that the way they treated Adolis this spring by keeping him, you know, kind of on a slow track here, after his the knee injury last year at the end of the year, and the fact that Adolis just gets a little bit worn down, the idea of him to me taking off at least one game a week from the outfield and being the DH is absolutely the way to go with him to keep him fresh all year long. And the idea that you would not be really losing anything, or not much anyway, by rotating these guys around like that, I just think that that's just almost a no-brainer to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that works against Justin Foscue making this team as the DH, is that Justin's limited defensively really to second base. He's moved around the infield a little bit and played a little bit of third and played a little bit of first. But the infielders don't take days off. You know, they don't want days off, with the exception of Seager occasionally. And I think the Rangers will try and get him some days off. But Zeke Duran is a very capable defensive shortstop. And so they don't have the same kind of need to rotate those players in and out of the lineup. It just makes sense if your primary DH is a capable outfielder, that's where the need would be.
Yeah. So real quickly, before we get out, let's talk about the infield now some. So Jared Walsh has had a really good spring, really had once been a very productive player for the Angels, had a couple of bad years. And everything I said just a minute ago about Wyatt Langford DH and then running it through other people, having said all that, I do like the thought of a Jared Walsh being there as a platoon DH. Obviously, he's a left-handed hitter. But I don't really see any way he makes this roster. Do you?
I think that he's indicated to the Rangers that he would go to AAA if he needed to start the year. That neurological situation last year was a significant issue for him, but he has certainly shown up and produced early. There's a long way to go in spring training. First of all, we've got three more weeks of games, but I also think that the only real scenario I see, barring a trade, would be if the Rangers said, well, we want to use Walsh as kind of a platoon DH, and we can get by with just one backup middle infielder. And so you go with Duran as your backup middle infielder, and maybe you send Josh Smith down to play every day in the infield that's the only scenario where I see that they could carry Walsh. And again, it makes it a little bit more difficult for you to rotate the guys in the outfield around quite as much without cutting into Wyatt Langford's playing time. So I think in an ideal situation for the Rangers, Walsh ends up to start the year at AAA and ready to step in if they need a bat, whether it's at DH or first base or anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Any updates on the health situation there? You still think that Josh Jung and Seager are ready for opening day? I think that Jung's probably a little closer to that than Seager is, maybe.
Jung has started doing baseball activities again. Corey is still progressing slow. And I think the key question will be where Corey is about a week from Thursday, when the Rangers will have 2 weeks to go until opening day. I think you'd want to see some progress then. I don't have any doubt that if you get him on the field for a week or 10 days of even controlled environment, this guy's so diligent with his swing and so good about getting things back on track. We saw what we saw last year when he went on the IL, came back without even taking a rehab day, and just raked the last 3 months of the season. So I think that he can certainly do that, but I do think the Rangers would like to get him on the field and taking ground balls a week to 10 days before they break camp.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny. We were talking just a minute ago about pitchers and how they develop, and you don't see things coming. You know, I don't think anybody saw Corey Seager becoming the player he was last year. You know, he was a very good shortstop. I mean, a very good hitting shortstop, but that was just out of sight what he did in 119 games last year for them.
Yeah, I think defensively he was superior to what the Rangers had expected.
Yeah, well, and even superior even offensively. No one was going to expect him to do that either.
I don't think the offensive numbers were all that, like, out of the range for what the Rangers thought he could do. Certainly it's the top end career wise for what he's done so far. But I do think the one thing that was a surprise was just how good he was defensively.
Yeah, he was much better. No question about that. All right. That's going to do it for our Rangers segment of the podcast. We're going to move over now and talk about the Cowboys. David, besides Dak having a baby girl, which this whole girl dad thing, I got to tell you, as a father, you're a father of a girl. Evan's got a girl and a boy. You know, you're just a dad. I don't understand. Was this like the 40s or something that, you know, oh, I'm a father, I got to have a son. You know, it's like, I'm just happy to get whatever I get.
I think we've evolved since the 40s, Kevin, but if you want to live back there and diminish girl dads.
My whole point, this whole girl dad thing, like,
if you want to minimize,
we're making a big deal out of it.
If you want to minimize young women and their accomplishments in our society, go ahead. I choose not to.
We were very, very excited about getting either one, girl or boy. We were excited either way. Yes. So anyway, so much for that. David, give us an update here on what is procedurally going on with the NFL and the Cowboys as we're taping this on Tuesday.
Well, as we're taping this, the franchise tag must be applied by Tuesday afternoon at 3:00 Dallas time, Central time. As we talked about several weeks ago, the Cowboys do not intend to use the franchise tag this year. They used it last year on their running back. They will not do so again. Tony Pollard, he will be a free agent officially as of this afternoon, but will be ready. Free agency starts next week, but he will enter the free agent market coming off his franchise tag year. And this is, this is economically driven in large part too. They need to, restructure some contracts of their key players here, get a little bit more money in place. And we've talked about this. This franchise hasn't made a big splash in free agency in a long time. It has not spent a lot of money on free agency. It has become a draft and develop team, which prefers to build through the draft. And they feel they draft well enough that once some of these players are about to enter their second contracts, they have someone in place to, you know, replace them and step into the role in a starting lineup that won't consume as much cap. They've done a pretty good job of this of late. That being said, every year there are always some decisions that fans will question. This year, probably more so than others, since Dallas is coming off, you know, three straight 12-5 seasons and two straight 12-5 seasons, excuse me, three, yeah, and are going to lose some key players in a year where Jerry Jones has declared publicly they are all in. The definition of all in varies quite a bit by who you talk to and what that perception is. So all of that is a setup. I think the biggest one and one that surprises a lot of people, especially, you know, Jerry sat down and had his bus interview from the combine last Friday, said that talked about how much they liked Tyron Smith and they expected that to work out, hoped it would work out. And then less than 12 hours later, we're writing stories that, well, after they met, the gap appears too wide, and there's a good chance that Tyron Smith will end his career in another uniform after being part of the rebuilding of this offensive line in Jason Garrett's first year as head coach back in 2011. So that surprises people, but I'm sure you may want to talk about that a little bit more, moving on from Tyron Smith.
Yeah, before I go there, though, I do want to just say one thing, because this has always intrigued me. You know, in that draft, when they took Tyron Smith, they could have had J.J. Watt. So looking back on that, let's get a vote across the panel here. If you could have J.J. Watt or Tyron Smith, who would you have rather had? Evan, you go first.
I probably always overvalue defensive linemen over offensive linemen, so I'll take J.J. Watt.
David?
Couldn't go wrong either way. Tyron Smith anchored one of the best offensive lines in the league for a long time. Left tackles, even in his later years here, he's still graded out. You know, before, there's no question he was either the best or the second best left tackle. That conversation, even at this stage of his career with all of his injuries, we're still just debating where he ranks in the top 5 to 8, which is pretty hard to do. J.J. Watt's career ended sooner because of the longevity and the position. I would lean toward Tyron Smith, but it's not a wrong answer to say J.J. Watt either.
No, I'm going to go with J.J. Watt. He was a dominant player, a Hall of Famer. Smith's a Hall of Famer, probably.
He is. You know, they're both Hall of Fame players, so that's why I'm saying you can't really go wrong.
That's kind of like that Akeem Olajuwon, Michael Jordan question, right?
Yeah.
The Rockets took Akeem, and they're happy with that, and they could have had Michael Jordan, but they don't get roasted like Portland did for taking Sam Bowie. So let's move on then to the Tyron Smith thing. If this is the end, to me, and I wrote a column a couple of weeks ago saying that if they kept Tyron Smith for signed to a 1-year deal, then I would like to see the Cowboys draft a guy like Tavondre Sweat with the 24th pick. But in this scenario, if you're not bringing back Tyron Smith and if you're not moving Tyron Smith from left guard to left tackle, then it's just a foregone conclusion you're going to draft a left tackle with that first round pick. One thing, there's just a lot of them. There's probably, as I've seen, like 6 or 7 guys, tackles that will go in the first round, all considered very, very good, very productive guys who might even be able to step right in and play for you. And doesn't that kind of just make it an automatic?
You would certainly tilt in that direction. I don't think there's any doubt. Even if he leaves and you move Tyler Smith outside to left tackle, with the way the talent stacks up and the fact that the Cowboys once again will be in the bottom third of the draft in each round, the fact you're still going to have some quality tackles there leads you to have, you know, you can pick up a starting right tackle too and move Terrence Steele inside to guard, which they flirted with last offseason. decided not to do because he was coming off a major injury and felt that he would be too far behind to really give him a chance to see what he could do at guard. I'm going to be fascinated to see what they do with Terrence Steele this offseason as well, especially after he struggled coming back off that injury. And no one doubts him as a run blocker, but he gets exposed at times out there at right tackle, and we saw that last year. But I think this offensive line, like I said, Tyron Smith was the anchor or the cornerstone on which this offensive line was rebuilt. And now that he's gone, I think you're going to see them undergo another rebuild. And I know people are, a lot of people are frustrated and going, well, wait, he was, look at the level he played at last year. How can you move on from that? How can you give that up? Let's take a step back from that. He found the fountain of youth last year. He recaptured a very high level of performance and started 13 games. But Mike McCarthy has been the head coach of this team for 67 regular season games over the last four seasons. Tyron Smith has been available for 30 of those 67 games. So less than half. And 13 of them came last year. In the previous 3 years, he played only 17 games combined in 3 years. So the very legitimate question is, was last year's performance an outlier and really not a repeatable level of performance in that many games for a player who is even 1 year older than he was when he did that, when you look at his recent injury history? And I bring this up because last year there was serious discussion about whether or not to move on from Tyron Smith going into last season. And the issue with him over the last 4 to 5 years has never been his performance when he's on the field. He's still one of the best offensive tackles in the game when he's on the field. It is just that he missed so many games. And how does that impact the continuity of your offensive line, your protection schemes, and how you go about it when he misses that many games? And I thought last year at one point that Dallas was going to move on from Ezekiel Elliott and Tyron Smith last offseason. But as the conversations progressed, later in those conversations, just before free agency, they decided, no, let's go at least one more season with Tyron Smith here. Let's see if we can make this work because he still performs at such a high level. You saw them get that out of him this year. But the question on great players is always, you always want to time it up perfectly, right? But usually the question is, do you move on from them 1 year too early or 1 year too late? And which would you rather do? And I think Dallas is erring on the side of, well, if we move on from him 1 year too early, let's do that rather than hang on and do it 1 year too late.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case going forward here. Well, it's going
to
be
very interesting. That's not to say they're going to be better because he played 13 games last year at a very high level. So now the question is what you were talking about earlier. Do you kick Tyler Smith out there, who played very well at left tackle as a rookie, and then go ahead and fill in a guard spot? But to me, the other issue you have is here, you're not just losing Tyron Smith. In all likelihood, you're going to lose your starting center, Tyler Biadasz, in free agency as well, because I don't believe they want to pay him what the market would demand, just like they didn't pay Connor McGovern last year and let him go, and Connor Williams the year before that. This is the other part of being a draft and develop team. Unless you reach a certain level of performance, they feel they have someone in the ranks who's ready to take over. So I think some of this is going to be in flux. I think, one, Dallas is going to have to sign a veteran swing tackle in free agency next week. Chuma Adoga was that guy this past year. He'll be a free agent again. He's a possibility. But that level of free agent to plug in to give you a little more comfort. And then I would say going into the draft, especially when you're in that, you know, when you're in the 20s, you're sitting there going, okay, well, let's take this left tackle and keep Tyler Smith at guard. Or you say, you know what, Tyler Smith's better than anyone we have here. Let's kick him back out to left tackle. But here's a pretty good center here late in the first round where you often get very good centers. So let's go ahead and do that. That's going to make our line better. So I think it's going to be a Jerry Jones likes to say he has a high tolerance for ambiguity. I think there's going to be a little bit of ambiguity going into this free agency and draft as far as how to handle the offensive line.
Yeah, there's, and that's very intriguing what you just brought up. I've always thought that Terrence Steele probably is a better guard than a better tackle. You know, well, if you move Tyler Smith to left tackle, if you move Terrence Steele to left guard, and then you could draft a right tackle later on. You don't have to draft a right tackle in the first round. You know, that's not something that's quite as expensive. So I think there are possibilities, but there's no question that if you're losing two guys, you're going to have to address that very high in the draft.
Sure.
So that's gonna be a problem. Before we get,
but you
out
know,
this Cowboys,
you do need to address defensive tackle as well. You mentioned it, and there should be some good defensive tackles late there in the first round. Although I will say those guys have taken on more of a premium recently, and there's no assurance those guys are going to be there when the Cowboys draft.
Everybody used to say that those guys were second or third rounders, and now they've moved up some because of the value that we've seen in what they've
seen. I think Dallas got caught a little bit on that last year. I think they really wanted a defensive tackle or a tight end there in the first. Before they saw just how good Ferguson was and what he's blossoming into. And I think that the top plateaus and the players they really like there were gone. And then it was, well, you know, Mozzie Smith's not going to be there in the second round. We really like him. Do we like him better, like early, mid-second round? Yeah, but we know he's not going to be there when we pick, so let's go ahead and take him now. And I think Dallas really diverted from what had been a very successful draft blueprint over the previous 5 to 6 years of kind of jumping off a half a plateau to reach for a position versus just staying there and going, look, this doesn't make sense here. Let's go ahead and shift gears and take the best player.
Yeah. Well, because right now those first two picks are not looking good. Real quick before we get out of here, I just want to address this because we just talked about if you're a draft and develop team, I think that's a good way to go. The one problem I have with that is that if you're always going with younger guys and you're releasing guys as they get older, and this is a team that hasn't won, right? It has won during the regular season. Then who on this team knows anything about winning? And I think that's an issue for this team. And that's one of the things that I'd like to see the Cowboys do more of is that you don't always have to be giving big money to people in free agency. How about making a trade? You know, the Cowboys are very reluctant to make trades. You know, they did make the trade last year for Trey Lance, gave up a fourth round draft pick for him. But that was a guy that's, you know, they just doing that for the value of what.
Well, Brandon Cooks and Stephen Gilmore, a couple other guys, and you know that worked out really good for their chemistry and what those guys added in the locker room. So I think Dallas will look in that direction some. That being said, because they use those picks on Cooks and Stephen Gilmore, they don't have as much draft capital in this draft. So that's why, look, Dallas isn't going to go crazy in free agency, but I don't see how they cannot sign more veteran free agents this offseason than they have in recent years just because of where they are with their draft capital at the moment.
Yeah, seems logical to me. All right, that's going to get out of our Cowboys segment and move over into talking about the Mavs, who are been a real Jekyll and Hyde here the last couple of weeks. They won 7 games in a row, seemed to get a lot of juice out of those two trade deadline deals they made for PJ Washington and Daniel Gafford. That carried over after the trade, and they just looked tremendous. And then they lost 4 of their next 5, including an embarrassing loss to the 76ers here at American Airlines Center on Sunday. You know, they just looked like two different teams, you know, everything that they gained from those trades. What Daniel Gafford was in the first couple of games after the deals were made, he's getting 16, 17 rebounds a game. He's getting almost, you know, as many rebounds as minutes as he's playing. It was just unbelievable to play. And then we were seeing games there where he was playing 6 and 7 minutes. And I realize there are matchup questions involved there, right? You know, Gafford's not effective if you've got him trying to guard, you know, Kristaps Porzingis in Boston, or, you know, that's not a productive thing to ask him to go out there 30 feet from the basket, and then you're negating all the value he has. But when I asked Jason Kidd the question, are Gafford's minutes dictated by the matchups? He says that it's dictated by whether he's playing well. And there have been times in Daniel Gafford's career where we've seen him not play well. And people felt like that was kind of, you know, kept him from being a starting center in the league. But the Mavericks weren't even really asking him to be a starting center. He was going to back up Derek Lively. And of course, against the 76ers the other day, it was just miserable, just a miserable performance all the way around by the Mavericks. They couldn't have looked worse, I didn't think. And then that's so when after the game, you know, the questions get asked, you know, so what happened? Where's the energy on this team? And Jason Kidd made a point that I thought was a pretty good one, is that when they are good offensively, and when the shots are falling, then they have lots of energy and they play good defense. When the shots are not falling, their heads fall, the energy drops, and they don't play good defense. And it's specifically, what he pointed out, was Tim Hardaway Jr., who is not particularly a great defensive player, but he is pretty good offensively. He started off the year gangbusters. He was tremendous coming off the bench. And then the last, 20, 30 games, he's just gotten progressively worse. His shot's not falling. Fans are going crazy about the fact that he's keeps putting him in the game. But the issue is, and I agree with Jason Kidd about this, is that P.J. Washington is not a scorer. He's certainly not a three-point shooter. He's gonna get some points, but he is not a consistent three-point threat. Neither is Josh Green. And those are the other two options. Those guys are not consistent enough shooting to be thrust into that kind of role as the third scorer behind Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving. And so, therefore, it is up to Hardaway. They have to get him going. If they cannot get him going, then they're going nowhere.
Well, and how many games do you lose in the standings and put yourself in a play-in position as you try to get him going, which is what we've seen happen after. This looked like a real good fit right when the trades were made and they ran off the long winning streak. But now losing four of these five, it shows you what a fragile team they are. And they find themselves in the exact same spot they were in the stretch run going into last year. Unlike a Stars team that made a move that appears to be getting stronger and is positioning itself, that I'm sure we'll touch on here in a bit, just to juxtapose where these two teams are going into the stretch run. But that's exactly right. I mean, this Mavericks team does not have a consistent defensive presence. Because it doesn't, that places a greater premium on the offense, and Tim Hardaway is kind of, he's not the most important player on this team, but he's kind of the leverage point, right? He's the guy where, okay, when everything's humming offensively, great, but if he's not, are you good enough defensively to overcome that? Dallas is not good enough defensively to overcome when he's shooting the way he is over these last several weeks. And so you get caught. You go back and forth because this is still a team with an offensive identity that hasn't developed enough defensively to compensate for that. And it, you know, Kidd nailed it in his description. You would think that, and look, Jason Kidd has always emphasized defense, but with where the rules are in today's game, spreading the court, defense is a different proposition than it was 10 years ago in the NBA. I get that. But this team is just not committed enough defensively and doesn't play enough good team defense to say, okay, well, Tim Hardaway's off tonight, so we'll get scoring elsewhere. They're just not balanced enough. And that lack of balance is really showing in this stretch run.
You know, one of the things I noticed the other day, Sunday, because I was out there, and you don't always see this stuff on TV. You got to be kind of sitting down there to see it. Luka is still, after all these games playing with some of these guys, frustrated by them. There was a play he threw a pass over to Derek Jones, and Derek had stopped, and Luka was counting on him to be going towards the basket, and then the ball just goes out of bounds, and Luka just threw a fit. You know, it was like he turned and looked at Jason Kidd like, what the heck? You know, what's this guy doing? And then later on in the game, Luka was coming down. He was trying to get Maxi Kleber to go back into the corner, and Maxi was kind of coming up to set a screen. And there was obvious frustration. And we know that when things aren't going well, Luka gets frustrated, right? And that's how he gets the technicals. You can just see it all coming and building. But these are things that also happened when Rick Carlisle was there, you know, the turning over his shoulder and looking at his coach and putting his hands up like, what are we doing? You know, and come on. And he had a couple of those moments on Sunday as well. And I know that these are part of the things. That's one of the reasons why Rick Carlisle is now coaching in Indiana. So they're playing, as we're taping this on Tuesday, the Patriots are coming in. Lord knows how that'll go after the drubbing they put on the Mavericks up there on that road trip. But how much longer do we think that Jason Kidd can survive in this frame? If the Mavericks, let's say the Mavericks just make the play in, you know, they don't, and if they get into the playoffs and then they win, if they're in the play in and they get in and they win a couple of games and get around, I think Jason's fine. If they miss the playoffs again, what are the chances you think that he comes back as the head coach?
Well, you have new ownership making decisions, right? And so we don't have a good feel for that yet. This group hasn't been in place long enough. But Jason Kidd was not put in place by the current ownership group who is managing this team now. There are not those ties. We don't know how they'll react. We don't know. Do they say, look, that I know I haven't been here long, but this clearly isn't working. We paid a lot of money for this. We expect to be one of the high profile franchises. We're going to make a high profile hire. Or do they say, well, I got to observe a little bit more and see where this is before making a decision that impacts the organization this much. We just don't have a feel on that yet, I don't think. And we'll certainly find out this offseason. Jason Kidd's issue is they exceeded expectations and went to the Western Conference Finals before anyone anticipated. And now you're faced with, for the second consecutive year, falling woefully short of those expectations that were set up two short years ago. And if you have two seasons of showing no progress with, Luka Doncic, and now Kyrie Irving, who, by all appearances and accounts to this stage, has been less of a dysfunctional addition than many people anticipated he would be. If you have two players of that level and you still find yourself in a play-in position, and you have one of the better rookies in the league, and Derek Lively, who's actually, you know, another piece you found going forward, That's a pretty precarious position. There's not a lot of bona fides you can tout as far as how this franchise is developing positively, other than just the talent in place. But the talent in place is not resulting in where you expect to be in the standings. So I think it's a pretty dicey spot for Jason Kidd and to some extent Nico Harrison as well. They were a package deal, right?
Yeah, they were. You got the impression when Patrick Dumont came in, he really spoke highly of Nico. I think that, you know, Nico's the world's nicest guy. He's got zero ego. And so, you know, I could see how a new guy would like him. And when he came in, if you're just looking at it from a personality standpoint, and Jason's a little bit of a different animal. And Jason doesn't have a great track record either, right? Didn't grow up so great with the Nets or with the Bucks. Both of those were not much to speak of, and things were certainly questioned when he was hired, and the hiring was seemed to be all about what can these two guys produce in the way of attracting free agents. Well,
yeah,
we haven't seen that happen, right? You know,
haven't seen that. And again, this is where we don't know. Where it's like, you know, DeMont is like, okay, he really likes Nico Harrison. Does he defer to him in a coaching decision this year? Because certainly Nico Harrison is going to lobby, I would think, strongly to retain Jason Kidd and say, look, there's just been a lot, you know, we've made a lot of changes here these last two seasons, that give it one more. You'll see that this is getting us back to where we were the, you know, conference finals a couple of years ago.
I would bet that he'll be back, but I would imagine he would be,
but I don't think you can say that with the same level of assuredness that you would have if Mark Cuban was still the owner and making the decisions.
Yeah. One last thing about the Mavericks. I thought this was interesting. What did you see the comments from Tim Hardaway Sr. the other day, where he was talking about the Mavericks and talking about Luka Doncic in particular, and just saying that, you know, and of course, Tim Sr. was a pretty good point guard. And he said, he said, Luka's just pounding the ball too much. He said, you know, basically, and he conceded. He said there are some guys that you're fine with them not getting their hands on the ball. They'll be fine. He says, my son is not one of them. He said, he's a rhythm shooter. He needs to get his hands on the ball more often. Luka's got to stop dribbling so much, which, you know, I do think that we've seen this year less of that. They've increased the tempo greatly over what they were the last couple of years. And I do think that Luka is giving the ball up to Kyrie more often and letting him handle the ball more. And so I don't think it's as much of an issue now as it has been in the past. But it was interesting, and maybe kind of some insider glimpse of what the real issue is for Tim Hardaway Jr. in trying to get going in this offense.
Well, if you're a rhythm shooter, as Tim Hardaway Sr. says, and there are a lot of those in the NBA, that's not going to be a good fit with Luka, because what do we always say about Luka? He plays at a different pace than any other player in the league. So if you're playing at your own rhythm and it's different from the pace and rhythm of the league, is that there's going to be, it's not going to be an ideal fit there. And that's why I, just because a player is great and has, and does give up the ball and is near the top of the league in assists, that doesn't mean that every player reaches his full potential with that particular style. And because Luka Doncic is a unique talent, I think it's a unique challenge to find the proper players to put around him.
Yeah, there's no question about that. You know, that was the same thing with Dirk Nowitzki as well. To me, that's kind of been the issue. They've had these great European players. Dirk's certainly a Hall of Famer, and Luka's on a Hall of Fame track. And there's a little bit of an issue, though, getting the right kind of players around him. All right, we've run out of time, and we're going to talk a whole lot about the Stars. Unfortunately, we didn't get there. Evan has some really hot takes about a couple of the deals.
Evan, go.
Yeah,
the Stars are kind of becoming like the Matt Damon bit on Jimmy Kimmel. That unfortunately, we ran out of time and couldn't get
time.
To Matt Damon. Just wait till Brad Alberts and Jim Neal come on with us that one time, and they're going to want to punch us.
Yeah, well, there's lots of people who would like to punch us, probably. That's why we're not
staying in line.
Yeah, that's right. Get in line, pal. All right, that's going to do it for this week. We'll be back next week for more scintillating talk about what's going on around here, and if the Mavericks continue to play themselves right out of the playoffs, or if they rally again. And we'll see some more clarity perhaps about the Cowboys and the Rangers. So from everybody in here to everybody out there, thanks, and we'll see you next time.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.